It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And please tell you all that today, half of the Fantasy 411 comes to you live from the ballpark of the Palm Beaches in beautiful West Palm Beach, Florida. I am down here at Nationals camp, and we're actually going to be talking to MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter Jamal Collier a little later in the show about some of the many relevant Nationals fantasy topics. But we start with some news that has just hit the wires within the last few minutes as we were doing final prep for the show, and that is Sonny Gray is injured and is going to be out for a few weeks. It looks like he is not going to pitch opening day. Sonny Gray was already kind of a question for a lot of fantasy players coming into this year. I think he was a guy we weren't sure where to put him. Where does this leave him now for you, Fred?
I think it pushes him kind of down to late rounds in a mixed league. I mean, now you've got the two reasons to want to avoid him. One is that he didn't pitch well last season and was injured last season. And now you add to that he won't be ready for the start of this season, and that's going to mess up his preparation. And I think kind of dull hopes for a bounce back. So now if you're looking for a sub-4 ERA from him, and he's always someone who is kind of out-pitching his peripherals. So, yeah, I'm kind of pessimistic now on Gray. And I late rounds I'm fine with, and you can put him on your DL to start the year. But I don't think he should be someone you're counting on in a mixed league rotation, do you?
No, I would have a hard time. I mean, he's a guy that I would look at as, if you didn't need anything from him at all, if your position in the draft was taking Sonny Gray at this point is all upside, then I'd happily do that. But yeah, he's not somebody that I would want to need to contribute to my team.
Yeah, round 23, round 24, so, and like I'm thinking a 10 or 12 team league, round 20, yeah. Something like that, where, you know, even when he comes off the DL in real baseball, you don't activate him from your fantasy
right.
DL for
yes.
a while and see how he looks and everything. And, you know, I mean, the one nice thing about drafting players like Gray who are going to start the season on the DL is it basically opens up a bench spot for you until they're back. And that could let you play with some hot starters at the start of the season and, you know, and then see where you're at when he comes back. And maybe you don't even activate him from your fantasy DL until May.
We move to another injured starting pitcher. And another guy who I think people are kind of wondering just how much he will bounce back, certainly less of a question than Sonny Gray is David Price. I don't want to draw too much of a parallel, but there is some. I thought this was an interesting story, a little bit of a Rorschach test, really, with how you viewed this news on David Price, because I think there were some people where their reaction was really excited. Like, this is great. David Price is fine. My reaction was definitely not that unguarded. I looked at David Price, the news on David Price, and them saying, look, he's not having surgery now, was how I looked at that. And that doesn't mean I think he's going to need it, but that's all they really said. And they said, in a week or two, we're going to check again and see how it is. But I still have significant concerns. I've just seen enough of these. I have seen enough times where the initial report, and I'm not even saying the initial report was inaccurate. That's not my point at all. I'm not saying anybody's obfuscating or anybody's wrong. But a lot of times we say, well, this looks fine, and we're going to check it again in a week or two. And in a week or two, it either looks worse or it's not better. And just I tend to be a pessimist on injuries, particularly when I hear words like forearms. So here's my take on Price. And I'm curious to hear yours, and I'll ask you a minute. And in short, my take on Price is, he's not going to be my first pitcher on any team anywhere this year. Where are you on him?
Yeah, I would be really nervous if he was my top pitcher on any team this year. I mean, we've left our prediction in the fantasy preview for him at 180 innings, which is kind of building in about 40 innings of missed time from like his usual 220 inning season. That's put him around 90th on the overall list. So we're kind of saying maybe round 8 or 9 in a 12-team league, maybe round 10 in a 10-team league. And that means that he's like a low-end number 2 or a high-end number 3 starter. To put him around some starters on our list, we have him just in front of Zach Greinke, Tanaka, Hamels, Keuchel, Danny Duffy. So we have him just in front of those. I mean, the upside of Price is that, you know, he's shut down for a few days. He throws this weekend. Everything goes well. By mid-April, he's in the rotation, and he throws 210 innings this year. I don't really feel like we can project that, though. And, I mean, we all know what the downside is, and that's zero innings. So we're not really splitting the difference between 210 and zero.
Right.
We're still being a little favorable with him. But, low-end number two, high-end number three, I think.
I would pretty easily take Price over Greinke at this point. But I think Price versus Tanaka is sort of an interesting question because, you know, you're kind of building in those same worries about both of them. They're different. I think Tanaka is more likely to throw 180 innings than Price is. I think the odds are that Price throws, like you say, 220 or under 100. I think it will be surprising if Price is at 180, which is not to say I think that's a reasonable number. I think that's where you come down when you sort of do the probabilities and kind of add it all up. But, you know, I think that Tanaka is much more likely to be at 180 and could be better on the rate stat. So I think that's an interesting question. I think if I were looking at those two guys right now, I'd probably take Tanaka first.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I think, okay, now going back to our Gray discussion, you said, and I agreed with you, that you'd want to be in a position where you're not counting on Gray. And I agree with that. I think my stance with Price is I'd want to be in a position where when I drafted Price, however my staff was set up, if he gave me the zero innings or the sub-100 innings, it wouldn't totally ruin my staff and my season. So I had two other starters that I felt good about, some relievers I felt good about.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you can lose your number three mixed league starter and recover. You can't lose your – it's really hard to lose your ace and recover.
Yeah. And here's the other thing on Price, and I do want to – he is not a do-not-touch for me. So the flip side of that is this. Say Price falls. Say you are in a place where you've got a couple of starters you like. You've sort of salted away your top five other needs. You kind of feel good. And we're talking, I don't know, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th round, wherever. He's fallen a little bit, and you see people don't want him, and you've got a couple of starters. Man, at that point, I am snapping him up, right? At that point where he's fallen, I am absolutely saying, yes, sign me up. Give me the possibility that David Price is the third starter on a monstrous rotation.
Yeah, I see that. On Tuesday, I did the Yahoo Friends and Family draft. I took Price 114th overall. I started that draft by taking Kershaw second overall. So Price is my number two starter, but my ace is so much better than other teams' aces that I hadn't taken it, and I then loaded up on hitters after Kershaw that I felt like, you know what, if Price is fine, whoa, do I ever have an amazing staff with Kershaw and Price at the top of it. If Price is not fine, Kershaw may be so good that he covers me not having, you know, a good number two starter.
Right. Move down the another pitcher injury. Houston Street apparently will start the season on the DL. We had already both sort of stated our position on him. Neither of us was really running out to pick him up. And I don't think, and it looks like in reading about him, it wasn't a given that even if he'd been healthy, he necessarily would have been the guy in the ninth inning. So I think the question is not, does it drop Houston Street on your board? Because he wasn't really on my board in the first place, and I doubt he was on yours. It does raise the question about Andrew Bailey and Cam Bedrosian, and do those guys move up your board? The problem is that Bedrosian also hasn't pitched. I don't think he's in any jeopardy of missing opening day. But, you know, for a kid in his position, you got to pitch to win that job. So, you know, one, what does it do for Bedrosian? But two, are you suddenly kind of interested in a very late flyer on Andrew Bailey?
AL only, definitely interested in a $1 Andrew Bailey and see if I could get a half a dozen saves even from him. In a mixed, I wouldn't be interested in Bailey, but it makes me just slightly more interested in Bedrosian because I felt all along that Bedrosian has the skills to win that job, but then you wondered if Street, with the veteran and the bigger contract and the long career resume, if they just give him the chance. Well, now Street can't have that chance, and Bedrosian, if he can be fine. I think his first spring appearance is going to be in the coming days. And if he can be fine through the rest of spring training and gets that first save chance, I mean, we could get in a situation where he has six saves when Street comes back, he's pitching well, and they just don't touch it, and he gets 35, 40 saves this year, and maybe you can get him in round 18 or 19 of a draft. So he's becoming to me now maybe near the top of my list of relievers that I'm interested in who don't currently have a closer's job, you know, in their pocket.
I think that makes sense. While we are talking about exciting young players and the impact of news about older players on them, the White Sox release Brett Laurie. Definitely a little bit of a surprise, not a total shock, but something of a surprise. I don't think it means we're going to see Yoan Moncada opening day. I do think it's another indicator of the way the White Sox are going, and maybe an indicator that we'll see Moncada this year before September. Did you bump Moncada up your board at all? Is he now a guy that you're maybe stashing with a last-round pick?
Yeah, I mean, we've been pretty optimistic with our preview on Moncada, and I've kind of been expecting a June debut for him. I think service time is going to be the factor with him, and I believe that if he's playing well in the minors, that once we pass that service time deadline, that the White Sox will be quite interested in having him on their team during the summer. I kind of felt that way all along, and now I feel even more that way, or at least that Moncada really controls his own destiny, that once mm-hmm. that service time date passes, if he's playing well, he'll get to come up. It's just a little more open for him now. I think he is someone worth stashing because he steals bases. And,
yes,
you know, and if you want to confidently believe that he'll come up in June, then you can probably count on some steals in the summer. So maybe you can be just a little bit lighter on steals in your draft. But the reason I really wanted to mention him today is I have received some questions on Twitter from people saying, hey, does this mean that maybe Moncada could be the opening day second baseman for the White Sox? And to me, I don't think it changes, and I haven't read anything that says it changes his timetable at all. These two moves are, those things are independent from one another.
Right, that's the thing. I don't think the moves are directly related, except insofar as it is another indicator of what's going on with the White Sox, that the White Sox are looking at the future, looking at the kids, and this is another indicator that they're not keeping around veterans' names. It just, to me, it's a more of an indicator of direction than about a specific position.
That's right, and I think once we get to the summer, there's nobody on that White Sox roster who, if Moncada is playing well in the minors, they'll say, well, you know,
right,
Saladino or whatever, you know, he's Sanchez. They're playing so well at second, we just can't possibly bench one of them. Those guys aren't part of their future. They're just placeholders.
Brewers are kind of an intriguing team to me. They've got a lot of guys I'm sort of curious about. It's just a team I'm just kind of curious to see how the whole thing goes. Keon Broxton apparently going to be up high in the lineup. Potentially a really interesting guy if he gets the opportunity. Where are you on Broxton, particularly if he's going to be a table setter in that lineup?
Yeah, then I think he becomes, I still don't think he's in the first half of a mixed league draft, but on the basis that he could get you 35 steals and 15 homers or something like that, even if it comes with a low batting average, I think now he's an interesting, like, mid or just past the mid rounds, like round 15-ish type pick in a mixed league where if you didn't get a base stealer early and you feel like you're doing fine for batting average, you know, he's someone who's really intriguing in that you can get potentially a lot of steals from him and some power. You're not going to get the one homer to go with your 35 steals. You could get 15 homers and 35 or 40 steals. To me, he's pretty interesting, although I have to acknowledge, you know, with the low average, there's a chance that he's hitting .170 at the end of April, and they're talking about not playing him every day. There is that risk with him. Like, is he someone you would feel comfortable counting on as your steal source?
I'd rather not have to do that. I'd definitely rather have him as a potential big bonus than, yeah, this is where that's going to come from.
Yeah, I mean, you could have also, and I said someone, if you didn't get a base stealer early, let's say you did get a Trey Turner or an Altuve, VR, someone like that early, but then you load it up on real mashers, you know, the guys who get basically zero steals, he could be your second steals guy where you think, okay, if this works, I got 100 steals from two players, and if it doesn't, I still have the one base stealer.
Right, yes. I like that for sure. We are going to talk to Jamal Collier in just a moment, but before we move on, I want to take a moment to talk to you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, they broke down the top 10 farm systems in MLB and interviewed Dodgers shortstop prospect Gavin Lux. Search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. Now we move on, and man, those guys, I know I've said this once already, but I'm going to say it every time we talk about them. I honestly believe there's not a site covering baseball anywhere that has two people better at prospects than Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. Those guys are exceptional. If you care about prospects, and if you care about fantasy, you care about prospects, you need to hear what they're saying.
Yeah, that's right, and in-season prospect awareness is so big in fantasy baseball, and I think it gets overlooked. Owners think a lot about prospects when their draft prep is happening. Then they kind of know some names. Then they stop paying attention once the major league games are happening. But the stories don't stop there. The prospects are moving up and down rankings and having good or bad seasons in the minors. And those are the guys who will keep you updated on really who's advancing their prospect stock, because the names that we're all talking about now, the Moncadas, they'll probably already be gone in a lot of leagues.
Now we'll take a few minutes here to bring in MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Jamal Collier, to talk about the various Nationals topics in fantasy baseball, and there are a bunch.
I want to welcome MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Jamal Collier, to the 411. A lot of news, but a lot of fantasy news around the Nationals, and the biggest ongoing news story is that of Max Scherzer. He just threw recently. It's unclear how, as far as once we get into the season, do you expect he should be completely normal? Do you expect any effect on his performance or his availability or anything? How do you kind of assess what the expectations for Scherzer should be as he deals with this finger issue?
I think if you have a fantasy draft that's going to come in the next couple of weeks, obviously we're going to have a lot more clarity as opposed to will he start the season on time. I think once he's able to get going and start pitching, I think only thing he's going to get is better. I don't think that right now when he's throwing with that three-finger fastball grip, he's not necessarily damaging his finger anymore. And eventually that'll heal. He'll switch to two fingers and he'll be good to go. I think the biggest case is, when exactly he can start pitching and building up his innings and stamina to exactly say, are we thinking about a month here? Are we thinking about a week? Or is he going to start the season from day one?
With the acknowledgement that it's really hard to know, he's only faced hitters once, with the acknowledgement that this is to some extent guesswork, based on what you've seen, based on anybody you've talked to with the club, any scouts you've talked to, anything you have been able to glean, is the life on that pitch, is the way that pitch acting the way it should be, or is there anything different to anybody's eye, scouts, you, catchers, hitters, anybody with the different grip on the fastball?
Everybody I say, Max included, said it's the exact same fastball. It just is a matter of that with the third finger on there, he doesn't lose anything movement-wise, velocity-wise, just a comfort thing. Mm-hmm. And, that he just had never done it before. And if he can do it, then there's kind of no reservations with it. I think if he was losing anything, or if you see him getting to games and he can't consistently maintain his velocity with it, then perhaps they might, shut him down or do something differently with it. But I think right now the fact that he is throwing and they're allowing him to continue to use that means that right out of it, they think it's the same fastball and he should be the exact same Max.
The other ongoing news issue in this camp is, of course, the ninth inning. It seems like Sean Kelly, if you didn't know anything, you just looked at a roster, looked at stats, looked at stuff, you weren't here. How is it not Kelly? I mean, he looks like the guy. He looks the part. He's got the performance. Is he emerging? Is he the guy to bet on? Or is it really a wide open race?
It's probably still early enough that it feels very wide open. I would probably put Kelly as the favorite for all those reasons you just listed. And I think he's probably best suited for the job. And I still think he will get it. But one of the things when they mention about, whether it be Dusty or Rizzo or anybody else who kind of mentions what they're looking for in a closer, one of the names, they keep mentioning is durable. And that's kind of their one knock on Kelly, is how durable can this guy be to go back to back to back or go 4 out of 5 or whatever they might need a closer to do. That's why we give Blake Treinen a pretty strong chance as well. It's, again, if you have a couple weeks before your draft or something, then you obviously will maybe have some more clarity on it, because it's still early enough in spring that these guys are just making their first, second, third appearances out there, and they really have not started evaluating it just yet. But right now I'd put Kelly as a favorite, but say Treinen is definitely not out of it.
Gotcha. We've got two other things and we'll let you go. It looks early as though Bryce Harper is Bryce Harper, and he is at the top of drafts as big a variable as anybody. Yep. It's a guy who went number one overall a year ago, and there are people who wouldn't touch him in the first round now. There was a lot of speculation about a health issue last year. I know the club consistently said he's fine. Based on how he looks, again, can't put much into performance. You're not looking at numbers, but based on how he looks, how he's moving, flexibility, all the kinds of things that you can glean. Does this guy look more right as you look at him now? Is this somebody you'd sort of bet on the over right now?
He is. It's tough. He's so talented, and he's shown it over and over again, just how good he can be. You are feel inclined to bet on that he's going to be that player closer to what he was in 2015, than what he was at the second half of last year, especially. I think he's going to have a great year. He is stronger. He put on some weight during the offseason, and he was very, you know, conscious of some balls that he thought he got all of last year went to the warning track, or they were flyouts, and he is wondering why. And he wants to put that extra muscle on to get those balls the extra 15 feet to turn into more home runs. I think that was the biggest thing last year, is that his power was almost completely gone in the second half, to get five homers after the break and one homer in the last month. So, so far so good. I mean, he looks good, and he's a guy I would still probably take that bet on. If you have one of those first couple of picks, obviously Trout and some of those guys who are sure things you might take first. But right now, I'm expecting big things out of him, that he'll be closer to what we saw a couple years ago.
And then the other guy from this club going very high on a regular basis is Trey Turner. A really short track record, but also just eye-popping potential. I think the thing people wonder about, everybody knows he's going to put the bat on the ball. Everybody knows he's going to run. He flashed some power last year, which was something nobody ever expected. Do you anticipate, like, I don't think anybody thinks this guy hits 20 home runs, but do you anticipate, or maybe we do, do you anticipate, is something like 12 to 15 home runs to go along with everything else a reasonable idea? Does he have more power for real than maybe we thought a year ago?
Yeah, I mean, he shocked everybody, including me, and I would have told you that he would not be able to put the power up that he did in the 70-some games last year. It's weird. I mean, your first instinct is to say, okay, he can't just take what he did last year and just double it. But can he? You know, it's kind of it's odd to say, like, this guy has shown the potential that he has, and shown that it can be for real. And I think, you know, obviously, is he going to do exactly double those numbers? No, that'd probably be insane, and he'd win the MVP next year. But he's a player, I think, that the power is going to be for real, where you're going to see him able to put double-digit homers. He's going to run as much as he did last year, so you're going to see his steal totals get up at least past 50, you know, potentially. And he's a guy who I think has also got the chance to steal hits on grounders and turn things to extra base. That'll be a big thing. You've got extra base hits as a category. You know, he'll be able to make singles into doubles, doubles into triples. So I like a lot of the qualities, and he's a guy I would not shy away from just because of the small sample size, and go pretty aggressively. I know he's going second round or so in most drafts, and I would probably go pretty aggressively with that.
Big thanks to Jamal for taking some time out of his very busy day. As I'm sure you know, beat writers in spring training work harder than any other time in the year. It is fun to be in Florida, and it is great to be back in baseball, but those guys, those women are absolutely working their behinds off every day, so really appreciate Jamal taking a few minutes to provide some insight. We now move on to second base, and it's another one of those where tier one is one guy, because that one guy is somebody that could be talked about as high as, I bet there are some drafts where he's being taken one overall. And that is Jose Altuve. How high? I know we talked about the very top of the first round already. Can you see a legitimate case for Altuve one overall in some draft strategies?
I just can't see the case. I don't know. I don't really see the case for taking him over Trout. You know, I think he's in play any time after that. He's not my preferred, even like second or third or probably even fourth choice, but I don't, unless your league had a really oddball scoring system, maybe where you had a lot of infielders and not a lot of outfielders in it. But other than that, I couldn't see him going number one.
And that's how we know that we're talking about a guy who's head and shoulders above, because it is a big gap.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's Altuve does so many things well, and does it at a really deep position. What you'll hear in a moment as we go down through this, this is a good position right now. And yet Altuve is still head and shoulders above. If you get him at three, at four, how does that kind of change your outlook for the rest of your draft?
Yeah, Altuve is interesting to me in a comparison to Trout, in that he's held elite value now for several seasons in a row while his profile has shifted. And a couple of years ago, taking Altuve early meant that you were, you know, heavy on speed and short on power when you started your draft. Now that we can project him for 20 home runs, or maybe at least close to 20 home runs, and then a steal total around 30, I think he's just a really nice way to start your draft. And with the high average, it kind of means that you can go in any direction you want in your subsequent picks, because, you know, you've already got an infielder, so you can go heavy outfielders if you want, or corner infielders if you want. You can go power hitters. And because his steals total no longer is, like, in the 50s, if you want to get a second base stealer, if that's the highest guy on your list, like, you can go there. So I think he's one of the more appealing ways. I like Nolan Arenado, for example, overall just as much as Altuve, but taking Arenado in round one now leaves you definitely needing something, and that being steals, in those next few rounds.
I know, you know, I talk a lot. It's one of the things I've sort of hammered on this podcast about, you know, steals don't tend to come back. When steals start dropping, they tend to keep dropping and then they go away. I am open to the idea that Altuve could be an exception to that. Do you think we are done seeing Altuve as an elite source of steals, or can you see something where he pushes that number back up and becomes one of the top base stealing guys again?
I don't know. If he doesn't go back to the leadoff spot, like if he's hitting third, I just don't feel like we're going to see another like 50 steal season. Now, he was 30 last season. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see 40, but I don't feel like we're going to see 50 again. I do think the range is quite wide for him. Like, he could choose to not run quite as much and be high 20s or something like that going forward. I feel comfortable still saying, like, 30 to 35, I think, is really reasonable for him.
All right. We move to Tier 2, and as is often the case, you get a wide range of different profiles here. Robinson Cano, Rougned Odor, Daniel Murphy, Brian Dozier. I like Cano a lot, and I think it's possible he could still be a little undervalued because of that one-year bump. He's so steady. You know, he's a little bit, to me, like a Miguel Cabrera in that he's just such a solid provider of base hits. He's going to hit for some power. You just know that this guy, there's an expression in soccer that is, you know, form is temporary, class is forever, class is permanent. I kind of feel like that applies to Cano. Cano is just such a good hitter that I really feel safe with him. And I feel like in some places there's still some sort of overly strong conservative feel about him because of basically one down year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think that Cano gets, you know, kind of victimized by just that whole theory of things being new and exciting and him never being that guy anymore. So there's just, and it's not even within second base. It's just overall in a draft, you know, there'll be young players that people expect to take a big jump, or there'll be players who had one great year and people expect them to follow it up. People are chasing that incredible season so much that they just overlook the value in getting your, you know, roughly 30 homers, 90 to 100 RBIs, 280 to 300 average from Cano. I think that Miguel Cabrera gets victimized by the same thing, where every year he's good, but you're chasing people get caught chasing the Charlie Blackmans and the Trey Turners and everything, and then just overlook someone who's good every year.
There's a lot to be said for a guy that you're really confident isn't going to disappoint you. The other interesting guy on this list to me is Daniel Murphy, because going into last year, I think there were a lot of people excited about what he could do coming off his big year the year before, and particularly his big postseason. And then he outdid everything. I mean, he went and is a rare case where there was hype and people were excited. And then he went out and exceeded the hype. He was better, I think, than even optimists were about him. To me, I can't help shaking the idea then that he falls back a little bit. How much of his 2016 do you think Murphy sustains in 2017?
Yeah, I do think that he falls back a little bit, but I wonder if some of his personal fallback could be offset by Bryce Harper having a much, much better season, and then also getting a full year of Trey Turner around him in the lineup. And I feel like those two things together might, where he personally might play a little worse, but not lose as many runs in RBIs as people think because of them. I will say overall, I actually love Tier 2 at third base. I think that those four options are just all, like, they're all a little different, but I think they're all really, I think that's one of the nicest Tier 2s of any position that we'll cover.
Yeah, all of those guys you'd be very happy to get. Frankly, nearly any of the guys in Tier 3 you'd be happy to get, though I think once you get down here, you definitely start seeing some of the warts on some of these guys. So Tier 3, D. Gordon, Gene Segura, Jason Kipnis, Ian Kinsler, DJ LeMahieu. You know, guys like Kipnis and Kinsler, pretty steady, pretty predictable. You have a pretty good idea what you're getting with those guys. D. Gordon, man, I have no idea what you're getting with him, other than pretty confident you're going to get some steals. Segura kind of the same way. I mean, could be really good, but also could not. You know, I think this is kind of a mix of safe and wide band. I think the guy I'm most interested in out of this bunch is Gordon, who never really became the guy last year that I think people hoped he would be. Where do you kind of have Gordon pegged as far as numbers this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gordon's the one who can most easily join that tier two because he's been in the tier two the past couple years.
Yep.
I mean, I feel fairly confident that you'll get the 50 steals from him. It's just whether you'll get a 290 average and 90 runs or a 265 or so average and 80 runs. To me, that range is not that great. So I feel pretty comfortable with him in tier three. I think I agree. Out of all it's interesting that tier three, there is a wide range for a lot of those players. Like his range is fairly wide. Segura's is really wide. He was amazing last year, and we don't know if he can follow that up. LeMahieu led the majors in batting average. Like his range is wide. Kinsler had so much more power than he's had in recent years. It's an interesting tier where probably one or two of those players mostly repeats what he did last season, and you can get them way down in tier three, but probably three or four of them don't.
Also, this is an area where, and this is something we've talked about a few times, where it probably does start depending on what you already have. There are speed guys and there are power guys, and so some of this will depend on whether you are set on speed and need power or set on power and need speed.
Yeah, I totally agree. And going back to conversations we've had, earlier in the winter when we were talking about how position scarcity is not nearly as much of a thing this year as it was in past seasons. And now that we're talking second baseman, and then in a couple weeks we'll talk shortstops, I think people will see that where, we're in tier three, and these are some really nice options. These are totally comparable to the tier three options when we were talking about outfield, and when we'll talk third base and everything. Like the position, the depth at second base is really good this year, and the depth at shortstop is quite good also.
And we move to tier four, and I think this holds even true. I don't think I'd be shocked if either of these guys played at the level of the guys we just talked about, Dustin Pedroia and Ben Zobrist. I'm not going to find it shocking if either of those guys plays at a level of the four guys we just talked about.
Yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, if you think with Pedroia, you're getting one of the more consistent hitters in baseball who hits high in a lineup that led the majors in runs last year. And with Zobrist, you're getting a really consistent hitter who will hit high in a team that could easily lead the majors in runs this year. So, I mean, when you're talking tier four, so almost everyone in your league already has their second baseman, and you can fall back on a guy who's not old, but maybe like age-wise a little past his prime, but can still get you 15 home runs, a handful of steals, hit 280, 290 maybe even, and then could score 90 runs. Like, that's a pretty nice option in the middle rounds of a draft.
My only worry with Zobrist, and to me what separates Zobrist from Pedroia is, they actually each have playing time concerns for me, but in totally different ways. Pedroia certainly has gotten hurt at times, but Pedroia is healthy. He's going to play every day. He's the Red Sox second baseman, full stop, and I really like that. I'm kind of willing to take the injury risk. I don't think Ben Zobrist is going to get benched, but I also, they've got so many options and so many different pieces and so many things that can go in so many different places. If Zobrist ends up playing 135 games, either because they're trying to keep him fresh, because they have other options for whatever reason, I won't find that particularly shocking. It's a fairly small margin. Again, Pedroia could get hurt and make that equation closer. But for that reason, I would lean Pedroia over Zobrist. Do you think there's a case to do it the other way around?
No, I definitely lean Pedroia over Zobrist. We've talked about that playing time crunch in Chicago and how Javier Baez will probably take the brunt of it. But even if a little bit of that spills into giving someone like Zobrist some extra days off. And I'll also mention with Zobrist that I try not to get too wrapped up in like small stats within a season, but last year in May, he hit six homers, drove in 25 runs, and batted .406. Outside of May, he was pretty kind of blah in all the other months. And the reason I note that a little more than usual is that his power production last year at 18 homers was his best since 2012 by a decent amount. Like, I feel like he really is more of a 12 or 13 homer guy and not the 18 homer. Like, he had 18 homers, 76 RBIs. When you think of how much that power just came in the month of May, outside of that, I don't know. I wouldn't want to pay for all of what he did last year.
I think that's totally reasonable for a wide range of reasons, as we just talked. All right, everybody, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk.